Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book Spider podcast. This is a Book of the Week format podcast which strives to provide the most thoughtful, the most insightful, the most analytically rigorous literary discussion on the spoken internet, while never condescending by trying to entertain you. Today we're discussing a fairly recent publication by the standards of literary fiction, which is Claire Louise Bennett's 2021 novel Checkout 19. Now, normally I would start this segment with a synopsis of the plot of the novel, but this is really, I'd say, an exceptionally unplot-driven work, right? This is one where the major events are almost entirely, and you guys might dispute this, I suppose. This is maybe one area of discussion for the book, but one where on a first read-through, I would say that the major events are almost entirely perhaps internal to the narrator protagonist. And this is a first-person work written from the perspective of a woman in, as best we can tell, probably her mid-40s, narrating various events in her life. It appears to be a British woman primarily living in Ireland. But the events of her life, to the extent that we're presented with them, are, you know, less so any kind of anything that has a conventional plot with tension or narrative drive, and more so a series of maybe thematically important events strung together with maybe a greater amount even of observational asides or of discussion of various authors that she read at different periods in her life, and the interpolation of synopses of stories that the narrator herself wrote. So, you know, what matters to the narrator, what takes the forefront of her attention as she narrates the book, for the most part seems to be, in descending order of importance, her relationship to books as a reader, her own sporadic creative work as a writer, and maybe in distant third, her experience directly with the literal world. And, you know, I'm going to be honest here and say that this is an example of a particular type of work that is very characteristic of the picks that I make for this show, which is something I really enjoyed, but I'm having a little bit of trouble kind of thinking or talking about, particularly having only read it once. You know, I think this might be a work that more than many would benefit from a second run through, but I don't have that advantage right now, at least not prior to the recording of the podcast. So, you know, I hope you guys, the listeners, and you guys, the fellow hosts here, will bear with me on that. Having mentioned the fellow hosts, as always, I am joined by the other two Book Spider gentlemen, Chris Malmberg and Patrick Barney. And so we're going to talk a little bit more about Checkout 19. And, you know, since I deferred and deflected a conventional synopsis at the beginning, rather than list what I perceive to be the novel's significant events, I'm going to ask you guys what stands out to you in your memory of this novel, right? You know, this novel has the quality of kind of a free associative river almost of language, right? And there are certain islands of narrative or scene or image which stand out from that river. And so I'm interested in identifying what those memorable bits or moments were to you guys and why you think they matter. So what sticks out to you just generally about having read this novel?
Well, I can say that, you know, one of the more powerful things that happens to the narrator, like outside of her stories or outside of the things that she's reading, is she's raped by a friend of hers, Dale. And that is thematically interesting as well, because of just like how much this novel explores the kind of female experience, and maybe more specifically the female writing, the female writer experience, the woman writer experience. And so, you know, that's something that is sort of explored conceptually in the books that she reads and talks about, and also the you know, some of her own stories. She has the one of her characters is a woman who becomes string and bursts into flame, kind of a domestic a spontaneous combustion from being mm-hmm. So engaged in domestic work. And so there is that interest in the female's experience, and then that personal experience that actually happens to her. And I don't know that any other, like, there's some other things that are she's as a young girl, she's attracted to a male teacher in ways that at the time it seems she doesn't quite grasp the full significance of, but she's enthralled by him. She doesn't have a ton of other things that stick out to me, like maybe Patrick can help out, that happened to her in the real world, outside of, again, her experience of other people's stories or her memory of the stories that she herself has written. But those two kind of bookend the novel, I guess. Like, she kind of, near the beginning, she's she is sort of talking about that that special attention that she is giving, and she feels given by this male teacher, around something that she has actually sort of created in the back of her notebook for class, and then the rape near the end of the novel.
Yeah, there doesn't seem to be a lot from her own life that happens in the novel. I mean, there are concrete situations. She does talk about concrete things beside those two things that book in the novel, like you said, Chris. So a significant portion of the story is the book burning that she depicts in one of her Tarkin Superbus stories, where, you know, we're talking about Nazis, and I read into that, like, a lot. Like, I thought that was an extremely important aspect of the novel for me, and it kind of activated a thought in my mind that I know we'll get to. So I think that's pretty important. And then obviously she writes a lot about what she's reading and what she likes to read, which at first I found deeply irritating and uninteresting. And it's kind of a thing that I picked up on when I first started to publish things for Kydra Kunis Books. You know, I'd read submissions, and so many would include, like, references to things that the writer or the character had read. And yet, like, they would never seem to, like, really have any thematic meat. The mentioning or the references never seem to have any thematic meat. Whereas I ultimately think that's untrue about this novel. I think it is important, like, all these things that the main character, the narrator mentions. And then, you know, speaking to the female experience aspect of the novel, she compares Anais Nin to Henry Miller, which is interesting. Like, I thought that was kind of a neat little thing, having read both Henry Miller and Anais Nin. I thought that was... I don't know if there's any more to that, but I thought it was interesting.
I'm glad you brought up the book burning scene, because I actually kind of had forgotten that. I think that there's, it's hard. No,
it's so important.
Well, it's so striking and weird, and like Tarquin has this kind of hallucination, or not hallucination, deeper insight into like something kind of possessing him at this book burning, which I guess context for people who might struggle to remember this particular moment, just because of the nature of this book, Tarquin's library has no actual writing in it. And there's a sentence. There's a sentence.
That's funny, because that's like the context that you gave is, I think, maybe somehow more mysterious than if you just...
I know.
Tarquin's library has no writing in it. Oh, okay.
It's just a bunch of blank pages.
How much background do we want to...
I know.
I feel like it's worth actually kind of... I think like, well... I don't know about... Sometimes when you like a thing too much, it can be tempting to assign too much weight to it, right? And I loved Tarquin's Superbus.
Yeah. Likewise.
I loved the character. I loved the interpolation of the story. I loved the story itself. I loved the way that it tied to the narrator's larger... Like, that felt to me... Like, the Dale bit feels like a linchpin. But Tarquin's Superbus kind of feels like the aesthetic keystone of the whole work, if not the thematic keystone of the whole work, and maybe also the thematic keystone as well, right?
Well,
so for what it's worth, I just want to try to see how much of that whole thing I can kind of put across in a halfway sane sounding way.
Yeah, better than what I was trying to do. Thanks for rescuing me, Hans.
Right, right. Well, I didn't mean to. I hope that didn't sound condescending.
No. But, go right ahead. Blow us away.
Okay, so I really don't know how much of this I can. I want to see how much of this I can pull from memory. So, one thing that we get in the flow of reminiscence is references to a character named, I'm just going to say Tarquin Superbus, because that's how I read it in my head. I think maybe the first name might actually be better pronounced Tarquin. So Tarquin Superbus, who is a character that the protagonist created probably in her, like, I want to say early 20s. And Tarquin Superbus is this kind of comic figure. He's a scion of a wealthy aristocracy who is a comic bumbler who kind of comes up with these schemes for self-aggrandizement, or is taken in by schemers and always kind of made a fool of as he fritters away his family's money on these ridiculous things that he's sold by people who appeal to his vanity and pride. And he has this friend named the Doctor, who is sort of a almost kind of a wraith-like figure. But also somehow both an ambiguous wraith and also a kindly middle-aged doctor, somehow kind of at the same time. And so Tarquin Superbus wants to appear learned and wise, so he purchases a library of all the greatest works of thought, right? He purchases a whole library at one go. And he's incredibly happy to have the library, and he has it set up in his he has it set up on these beautiful shelves, and thinks that it will lead to him being perceived as wise and thoughtful and educated. And at some point, realizes everyone in the village is laughing at him behind his back, and he opens one of the books and discovers that every single book that has been installed in his library is blank. And he would not even have known that if he hadn't realized people were laughing at him, right? Because, of course, he's interested in the appearance of being learned, but it would never occur to him to actually read any of these books. So he's spent this huge amount of money on this vast library, which in practice is just full of blank pages and makes him look like a buffoon. So he tells the doctor about this, and the doctor says, wait, no, this is a... kind of a special object, right? This library is a special object. In one of these books, there is one sentence. And if you find that one sentence, it contains within itself like the whole knowledge of the universe, right? And you just have to hunt until you find that one sentence. And this is kind of like this library is a magical object that seeks, it moves through the world of its own volition and seeks an appropriate recipient. This is all great fun to say. I love this story. And so Tarkin begins, he spends about 5 minutes one morning flipping through these blank pages trying to find this one sentence, and almost immediately becomes tired of the whole thing and just decides, well, I'm going to go have a fancy breakfast instead and fuck all this. And but when he makes that choice, when he leaves the library, everything around him just begins decaying, essentially. His cream all goes sour immediately, and his nectarines go from green to rotten with no ripe in the middle, and his housekeeper has, I think the word was, a globuliferous period and soaks her ruins her pants.
Yeah.
and he blames it on this enchanted library and burns them all, right? Has them all burned. And that, I think, is the sequence that we were talking about when we talked about the book burning. And the story of Tarkin Superbus is split basically into two halves, one of which appears maybe, I would say, about a third of the way through the novel. The other half appears about two-thirds of the way through the novel. And in the second half, we learn... So the smoke from the book fire, Tarkin breathes it in, and it makes him feel, you know, rotten. And he, like, spits out a gob of black phlegm. Yeah, he spits out a glob of black phlegm. And then as he's sleeping, the glob of phlegm begins crawling, like, up the wall toward his window. And it's revealed to us that that is the... it's the sentence, right? The sentence has kind of like come out in the smoke and then infected him and then been kind of incarnated as this glob of nastiness. And that's as far as the story ever goes, because we're told then that the narrator's boyfriend, when she was living in Ireland in her early 20s, the narrator's boyfriend, because of his jealousy at the way that being a writer insulated her from him, that he just tore it all up and threw it in a pile in the middle of the floor. And the story can never go any further than that, because she lost something when that happened, where she can remember and rewrite and develop even and elaborate on everything up until that point, but she can't write after that. And I think that in some ways, like, that almost kind of the scraps on the pile of scraps in the middle of the floor, like, that kind of echoes the book burning, right? I mean, the book burning... When she describes the book burning that Tarkin carries out, there's this long kind of tie where she talks about the Nazi book burnings, right? Mm-hmm. And how she was maybe kind of subconsciously influenced by those, by the Nazi book burnings, when she made that scene. And there's a little bit of a resonance there, I think, between all those images, right? The Nazi book burnings and Tarkin's book burning, and then her boyfriend tearing her story up and you know, leaving it in a pile in the floor. So, yeah, I mean, I guess that's the synopsis that I didn't give at the beginning of the podcast.
But that's only like one interpolated story within the larger novel.
It's one interpolated story, but I mean, this is theoretically all still a response to the question, what stuck out to us from reading this novel, right? And that interpolated story, the interpolated story and the relationship that it has to her relationship with her boyfriend, the interpolated story and then the way that the story is cut off by this petty act of vandalism by this man that she lives with, like, that's... Much of what the novel is about, much of what it's interested in, is kind of condensed very cleanly into that segment, right?
Yeah, agreed. And I want to, and this is probably like probably complicating, you know, uselessly, but I think that one of the aspects of the novel is not useless complications, but seemingly arbitrary complications, like the kind of wandering perspective of maybe a more the maybe particularly wandering manifestation of a more feminine perspective of a woman writer's perspective, and how that's, you know, kind of shut down at some point. She says what she said. I kind of wrote it down to help me. I don't have it word for word, but the reluctance to credit, you know, a particular woman writer, Quinn, I believe, that she was reading at a time in her life, the reluctance to credit her with capacity to write demonstrated the pitfalls of criticism written almost exclusively by posh white blokes, which I kind of liked. But one thing that she drew attention to in that is like this kind of paradox of a kind of working class woman's experience, where simultaneously the life is extremely boring but full of huge big problems, and so like this and challenges, and like that paradox, that tension between, you know, being in investigating, being caught up in the minutiae of daily life that is mundane but also momentous, can kind of generates that that like sort of the kind of stream of consciousness that can sort of bound from one point to the next. And so, and the reason I brought that up is that like that this arbitrary thing about Tarquin Superbus's story that I thought of while you were telling that, while you're recounting it, Hans, is that she kind of breaks this telling of Tarquin Superbus's story at multiple points to say like, but that's not how I had originally wrote it. Like, I didn't write it that way. It's just sort of how I'm remembering it, because since then I've read Borges. Right. She says at one point, like, I think that she didn't actually write that there was a sentence, a magical sentence in the library, because it was just that all the pages were blank. And then in kind of revisiting that memory of this thing that she had written and has since stopped writing, has not returned to, she has added these details that are more Borgesian, more magical realism, more surreal and fantastical, and so like there's this effect where like even though we're kind of going back in time in a way, revisiting these stories that she wrote at a point in her life, they're refracted through who she is now in this very explicit, very like kind of like very complicating way. It's like why is this a thing? I say why is this a thing because I don't know that I understand it, but I did love it. I thought it was very interesting to be confronted with this lens that is so sort of like transparent about how it's been shaped by the different authors and writers, authors and books that she has read, and turning that lens back to something that she had written, have the authors that she has read since that point in time change what she has written, like just explicitly and fundamentally shift it and make it richer and stranger. And I don't know, I really loved that.
And I think that effect too makes it more poignant that she can't continue the story, right? She can reimagine the story, she can add, I mean, the sentence is kind of, in a way, the most important part of the story. And it's hard almost to imagine,
yeah,
given the weight that she assigns to it, it's hard to imagine what the story even could have been up to that point without the sentence, right? So it's very tragic that she can't, I mean, the kind of psychological I mean, it's sort of an overused, cheapened word, right? But the trauma of what happened around the story is there's a way that that has weighed on her experience of creation where she can't move forward beyond that traumatic point, even though she can, in fact, create, right? It's like she can create, but she can't. She can create, but she can't create beyond the point of this trauma-induced fracture. And that's it's very sad, you know. It's it feels very authentic, right? Like it makes a lot of sense, but it's a tragedy in its way. It's, I mean, the story kind of, as much as anything, like the novel kind of is like the tragedy of the tragedy of the story of Tarkin Superbus. I wonder too. I mean, one of the characteristics of the narration, I think, is the ways in which, even though she's very interested in the question of female experience, even though she's very interested in kind of narrating the impact of, you know, sexism and these things and things like that, at the same time, she has a way of playing down. In the way that she describes things, she still has this way of playing down the description of what we understand on some level to be very painful and traumatic, right? So, like, there's a kind of a flatness almost, like a flatness or a removal and a neutrality to how she describes the finding the story shredded, even though we can tell contextually that must have been this very hard experience, this very traumatic experience, because of the way that, again, it's created that fracturing point where she can rework and add and kind of take this great creative freedom with everything that happens up to that point, but can't move beyond it. And I mean, I think that, like, there's a level of grief that we can extrapolate from her inability to move forward with the narrative that is much greater than what she'll admit to in the way that she frames things or discusses things, right? And that it's a little bit, it's a bit like actually the Dale sequence, right? I mean, the rape, and then the really weird and unsettling thing about that is not just the rape itself, but the way in which, a few months later he calls her and he says, "Oh, geez, when you came back from Brighton last year, I raped you, didn't I?" And he gets really mad at himself and he stops drinking, and it's, what do you make of something like that, right? Like then she, like, goes and stays at Dale's mother's house and kind of has this continued relationship with this person premised on this very kind of, no doubt, heartfelt, but also ultimately very unsatisfying apology and kind of moment of clarity that he has afterward. And there's a way in which the emotional impact of the moment is very underplayed, and you have to kind of draw it out from, again, from her kind of relationship to her creative work or from how it's impacted her creative work. So we've talked a lot about the Tarkin Superbus section. We've talked a bit about the self-immolating, the kind of fairy tale-ish parable of the self-immolating woman. The title, Checkout 19, is a reference, if I'm remembering correctly, to her having a job in college where she worked at the 19th checkout stand in a grocery store. And it's an interesting choice of a title because, I mean, I think if it weren't for the title pointing to the significance of that image or that setting, I don't know that I would have thought much of it, right? There's an extended sequence where, if I'm understanding correctly, the flow of ideas, and maybe you guys, if you caught this a bit more cleanly than I did, where it kind of shifted from memory to fantasy, maybe you can correct me. when she was working at the checkout stand, there was a Russian man that she would see come in who was very, very energetic in this sort of almost uncontrolled, bizarre sort of way. And he would run around swinging his basket and kind of go on this great quest, which would then result in like three small items. And at one point the Russian man just kind of spontaneously from nowhere gives her a copy of Beyond Good and Evil. And there's a sequence, if I remember correctly, where the memory of the Russian man kind of free associatively morphs into this image of him as a circus performer. And as a circus performer, somehow inspiring this kind of mass erotic act where all of the women in the audience begin fellating the index and middle fingers of the men that they're with. It's this very kind of surreal, her memory of the image of this Russian man kind of through the stream of consciousness turns into this sort of grotesque, surreal vignette, which is, you could argue, I suppose, one of the kind of interpolated pieces of creation, right? I mean, that long sequence, the fantasy is of a piece in a way, maybe with Tarkin Superbus and with the parable of the self-immolating girl and a description of a drawing that she's done, some things like that. But the fact that the title of the novel connects to that sequence really seems to signpost it as significant, but I don't know for sure how to fit it in relative to a lot of the other stuff, particularly in light, particularly in a way that accords it kind of the significance that the title connection seems to. Did you guys have any thoughts at all about that segment?
I thought it was striking, but I don't know, other than being striking and having some eerie kind of like Stepford Wife kind of tones to it, all of these women in lockstep taking their husband's fingers or their male partner's fingers into their mouths, and it's from the male perspective, right? It's not from,
yeah,
because it's he's sort of struck by this moment that with his wife taking his fingers into her mouth, and it's very, very dreamlike and eerie, and there's a kind of I don't know if I understand this correctly, but the way that I took it, the thing that I took away from it is a kind of a sense of appreciation for like what this circus performer magician has accomplished. And I think that kind of appreciation for this sort of mass sexual act is a little weird and eerie, you know, measured against the relative or apparent lack of agency in the women involved. But I you know, I don't know, like, this is one of those things where you mentioned reading it twice. I don't even remember. I think the male point of view's wife says something like, ta-da or something like that. Right. She says presto or kind of like a magician or, but I didn't, I, you know, I think other than its eeriness and its strikingness, it's super striking and weird. And I loved it. I don't know necessarily beyond how it makes me feel a little bit uneasy about, you know, again, agency. I don't know what to do with it.
I wonder if it's there partly just as a reflection of the pleasure of creation, right? Kind of a relatively pure pleasure of creation. It makes me think a little bit, and I don't know, as I develop this connection, maybe it'll seem more strained, but it makes me think almost of, I don't know if you guys, Chris, I believe you've read Mao too, but probably not for years and years.
Yes.
Mao 2 by Don DeLillo. There's a character in Mao 2 who is a thwarted, well, not a thwarted novelist, but a famous novelist who's been pretty blocked for a pretty long time. And he talks a little bit about his memory of inventing baseball games as a child, right? Just like lying in the dark and imagining the narration of a baseball game and how it was just this act of pure creation for no audience other than himself, and nothing that he's done since then has had that, you know? And it makes me think a bit of that, right? Like really kind of this moment when the imagination is allowed to flower freely without the pressure to make sense, without the pressure to say something thematically coherent, with kind of hints of that, but not really any kind of clear statement intended to it. And I mean, it's like so much of the novel is kind of about the narrator's flow of thought and the narrator's flow of thought and feeling and how those tie to, I don't know. Is it just, it's just there to be joyful and associative, you know? And it, I know that it maybe is not joyful, but it feels like almost a kind of joyful thing to free associate. What were you going to say, Chris? I'm sorry.
How do you earn that? How do you, it seems like, you know, if writing is a craft and that craft is measured, you know, basically like we're not, you know, necessarily carpenters making, you know, end tables and desks, and like the measure of a good end table or desk is like, it doesn't give you splinters and it, you know, like it holds things and it's stable and the drawer slides in and out and all of that. But writing has structures of, you know, and heuristics that like help readers identify, you know, what's happening, what's going on, like, you know, how's something being done? How's something being done well? And so it strikes me as like, you know, for someone to value the, you know, the childlike inventiveness of, you know, the childlike creation and the joy in that, how is that something that, you know, substantiates its existence in like a novel? And I don't mean to be attacking it. I sound like I am, but like, I think it's just something inherently interesting where like, when we're talking about, you know, these books in Book Spider podcast, and I think we're kind of led a little bit by more intellectual than like sensual, more intellectual analysis than sensual, sort of like, you know, like talking about how much we liked reading this or pleasure. That thing. Reading pleasure. Yeah. So like, I guess like, how do you reconcile? Let's go back to my original question. How as a writer, do you earn the right to kind of just create and have that be enough?
Do you mean within a text? Like, yeah. How does this text earn the right to have a kind of a fenced off section that's just creation?
Yeah.
Well, it's hard to.
You don't.
That's one possible answer.
I was curious what Patrick thought.
I mean, I think in the case of this novel, boy, I'm going to try to find a way to say this that doesn't seem crass, right? Because I really like this novel and I really appreciate what it has to say about gender. I think from a certain standpoint, the fact that it's like, quote unquote, a novel about gender, right? Or quote unquote, a novel about the female experience, or quote unquote, a novel about sexism. When you give something a clear statement of intent like that, or when something has the possibility to be read through a clear statement of intent like that, that's one way that you earn the space, I suppose, to do a little bit of pure play and kind of get away with it, right? Because like, there is a socially valuable point to the work. We've given the work a socially valuable point. So, you know, you've done that. You've, for marketing purposes, you've done that. For attracting a readership purposes, you've done that, right? You've done that to allow people like us to kind of say something smart about it. And so it's like a big box has been checked and you now have a little bit of freedom to play in the margins because you've done the social utilitarian thing, right? I hope that doesn't seem too crass, or like I don't mean any of that in a reactionary way.
But you can say it's not frosting on top of frosting. Like there is like a substance, like exactly. A declared substance that like, you know, like, and
this meal has fiber.
Yeah,
this meal has fiber. So I'm gonna have some fun putting some frosting on top of the fiber.
Yeah, and she does like very lucidly like write about male criticism, the repression of the female voice in other parts of the novel. But Patrick, you said no. Could you talk about no? What do you have? What problem do you have with the female voice, Patrick?
I don't have any problem with the female voice. I think I said no. Well, halfway is a joke, but also like, I don't think as a writer you ever can just create like for the play, like for the pure fun of it. I don't think that, like, unless you're doing it for yourself, like the writer in Mao Tu, who is just seeking to entertain himself, and then you can just create and have and do whatever you want in your head to your heart's delight. That's totally fine. And if you are only writing a book for yourself, for no one else, then you can do it. But if you have the idea that anybody else is going to read it, then whatever play that you have has to be at least frosting on a more, not healthy, healthy is the wrong word, but frosting on
fibrous,
on an item that has more substance than just the frosting itself. Like the way Hans explained it, I really liked. But he was taking, it seemed like you were explaining it in a way that I would disagree with. You're like, this can have frosting because it also has substance. And I'm saying without the substance, the substance is what's important. And if you want to play around and mess around with things, that's okay, but you're probably only doing it because, you know, the conventions of the time say that you have to be ambiguous, or you can't just say something out and out. You know, you it has to be, I don't know.
Within this novel, a lot of what I was saying when I was talking about getting away with it, I mean, to some extent, I meant that generally, not so much in relationship to Checkout 19, right? But like, Chris's question was more like, how do you get away with it as an author? That was as a general statement, how you get away with it as an author. To apply that concept to Checkout 19, you could argue perhaps, and I might be misunderstanding or missing something when I say this, I think that based on my probably incomplete understanding of the book, the Tarquin Superbus material, that has the frosting, it has the play and it has the meaning, right? There's a great sense of play and invention in it, but it's very focused on, I mean, it's compelling and it's also thematically relevant, right? Both within itself and in terms of how the sexism of her boyfriend stops it, right? So it does both those things in a very integrated way.
Right. So it's not really frosting. It just, it tastes like frosting, but it has deep substance to it. Like what makes it useful is that it is deeply thematic.
Do you think, Patrick, that the balance of frosting and nutrition is maybe inconsistent within this novel? Are there some places where that balance is better rendered than others?
There are probably places where it's better rendered. Like I think we agree that the Tarquin Superbus story is functions as both the substance and the frosting taste, to continue the metaphor. It's like it's both things at the same time. And I think just from the fact that it sticks out in our memory so much, it's probably better at occupying both positions at the same time, or performing both functions at once, than does like the immolating girl or the finger blowjobs. Like the finger blowjobs are way more ambiguous and maybe like an area where the novel doesn't function as well as it does with the Superbus stuff.
I think that's probably true. I think I agree with that. I also, if I read this again, I would really love to be able to draw nutrition from the finger blowjob scene.
Sure, mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. We all would. Right. Like, it's an inventive, interesting scene. Like you said, it's inventive, it's interesting, it, like, you want it to, like, be something more than just surreality.
I have a cold thought. I mean, like, is this cold, not cold, but, like, more appreciative of the writer's inventiveness, Bennett's inventiveness. Are these, do you think that these are existing stories that, you know, just didn't go anywhere? Like, you know, we all have that folder on our computer that's full of like, just like fragments of things, that some of the fragments are bigger than others. Some of them are more or less complete, but they never, you know, found an ending, or they, you know, you never got it published. And then, you know, you know, she's got one book out already. She's got one book of short stories, Pond. And then she can just sort of like go back in time, you know, in her head, and kind of like sort of thread a novel through these stories that she's written, and she can kind of pull them together. And that's, like I said, that does sound cold actually, but, and I don't mean for that to be disparaging. I really love this novel. But I guess like the simple way of asking it is, do these stories exist before this book is written, or are these stories created through the writing of the novel?
I mean, almost absolutely they existed before this, right?
I think so too.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think most long works, and maybe it's different for you guys, but I mean, most things that I have created that were longer than anything I've created that was longer than a single song or a short story involved some amount of, I've got a bit, I've got a scene, I've got an idea, I've got a phrase, I've got another one over here. You know, like you, I think if you're a creative person, you almost always have bits and fragments.
Right.
If you're a creative person, you almost always have bits and fragments, and they generally can be slotted here and there in a longer work. Now, I mean, I do agree with you, Patrick, that that's almost always a part of the process of creating a longer work.
Right.
That being said, I think, Chris, that your point is that engineering, you can imagine that engineering being more key here, right? Like, you've written Tarquin Superbus, and you become very interested in almost, like, I don't know that I've ever had this happen to me, right? But, like, I can almost imagine, like, writing Tarquin Superbus and thinking, who the hell would write this? and like reverse engineering a kind of creative individual around this thing you have made, you know? And I mean, for what it's worth, Claire Louise Bennett was born in Britain and lives in Ireland, right? I mean, it's maybe not ultimately helpful to go too far down the, you know, rabbit hole of how autobiographical is this, but I can't imagine that this is not, you know, this is more autobiographical than, I don't know, a Louis L'Amour Western, right? Like, mm-hmm. I think this is a lot closer to lived experience than probably the majority of fiction.
Right. That's actually one of the reasons for my next podcast's pick, but more on that later.
Narnia?
Yeah. C.S. Lewis meets Jesus. And, you know.
Yeah.
It's a lion.
C.S. Lewis was at the zoo and he saw some weirdos sacrifice a lion, yeah, and he thought, I can work with this.
Exactly. I just want to point out that I've been silent for a big portion of this discussion because we haven't really been talking about what I think is interesting about the novel. We haven't really hit on the things that I think are most important. Like, you guys have been talking away and I'm like, you guys are morons. Like, this has nothing to do with what we should be talking about. Not really. Like, I don't think you're morons. I think that your concerns are different than mine, and my reaction was extremely different than what you guys were saying. So specifically,
excellent.
Specifically talking, well, I have two specific things. One thing that's cool, though, I don't think these are mutually exclusive. Like, what your reaction was and what my reaction was are not mutually exclusive. So what I found super interesting about the Tarkin Superbus interpolation and all that, like, you guys saw it as kind of a reflection of her experience with her boyfriend, and then with extrapolating that from that with men in general, which I think, you know, is a reasonable trajectory to go down. But, like, I feel like we're underplaying, like, the hallucinatory references to Nazi book burning, which is really an excellent counterpoint to her infatuation with reading and books and writers. Like I said at the beginning, I really find it irritating when writers just kind of just reference things they've read. Like, it's not interesting. It doesn't have any thematic meat. And this is the road I thought the book was going down, and I wasn't very interested. But then when we get to this hallucination or this hallucinatory description of the Nazi book burning, one thing that this reference to the hallucinatory references to Nazi book burning does is put all of these allusions and references to writers and literature in a more interesting light. And at this point in the novel, it becomes not just a kind of a newbie writer's method of trying to look cool. It actually becomes something significant where we realize that reading is itself anti-fascist. Because, you know, when we're burning all these books, like, they just burn everything. Reading is anti-fascist. Reading is a revolutionary act, to use a ready-made phrase. And so I was really interested in the political context of this work and, like, what it was saying politically. And that seemed a huge thing to me.
As far as the political aspect of the work goes, I think that a lot of it seems to be more about the political aspect of exploring the experience of being a woman in the culture that she's in. Much of it seems to me to kind of be more about the day-to-day texture of it, more so than something that can be summed up in an easy kind of sentence or phrase or something that can be turned into an argument. And the particular, I mean, I think that, like, the Dale scene, the Dale scene seems notable to me to be more so about the texture of an experience that is in some way very characteristic, and about probably, like, the ways in which our language for that or our way of understanding that is almost necessarily limited or reductive. But if you try to boil it down, I mean, I think you can say that it's about the texture of the experience and about the ways in which language somewhat fails the two characters in processing it or coming to a more positive, such a shallow word, but the way that language fails the two characters in terms of processing it and coming to some sort of resolution that means anything to either of them, right? Like they try to talk about it and they can't really in a way that helps at all. Maybe because, and maybe the just the fact that language is an imperfect vehicle, maybe, you know, the language is a perfect vehicle for internal experience for this narrator and an imperfect vehicle for actual communication. So, Chris, I mentioned in passing the whole kind of the idea of breakdown and the idea of whether or not the narrator is in a very, to use the absolute most reductive two-dimensional word for it, insane, right? Or what it means to process this partly as a reflection of, let's say, a fractured mental state. Did you have anything you wanted to add about that? Any thoughts about that? Or should we leave this bit in the can?
No, I think, like, because some of the takes that I read on the book, I think the New York Times review talked about Checkout 19, like, as a memoir, like a fictional memoir constructed not on moments in one's life, but on books one is reading or writing. So basically, like, rather than focusing on the things that happen to you, focusing on the things that you're reading and the things that you're writing at different points in time in your life. And I think that that's kind of an oversimplification, but I do like it as a, it does feel a bit like the things that the narrator is either reading or writing are more momentous or important than what's actually going on in her life at any given time. For the most part, I think the rape or other things kind of rise to sort of break that, the surface tension that sort of mostly keeps the things that go on in real life for the narrator under and sort of allows the things that she really loves, the books in her life, to kind of stay stay prominent. And but we do get hints of, you know, her life. Like she mentions Dale's concern about her. I think it was Dale, because there was always something wrong with her. There was always something wrong in her life, or something was always going wrong for her. And then she, you know, mentions, you know, killing herself. The, you know, not reading books by writers who have killed themselves, because she doesn't want their suicidal inclinations to cloud her own suicidal inclinations. And then at the end of the book, she's, I think it seems like, occupying her now. I don't know how you read that necessarily. And staying in a house of a family where there are kids, and she's kind of somewhat worried about being, you know, perceived as a weirdo lady, you know, drinking to excess upstairs. And so there's these hints of a kind of a, you know, even though we're traversing a kind of a fictional thread, there is a, again, this gets so complicated when you're talking about a book where there's a fictional thread inside of a fictional thread, but basically we're traversing a thread that follows mostly fiction in her life, when, you know, the narrator's actual life is full of a lot of drama and intrigue and problems. And so I don't know exactly, like, if I kind of don't think of it as like a breakdown. I think of it as she's a person who would be maybe perceived, like, she occupies a kind of a marginal space as a woman, as a you know, a woman writer, as a woman writer who maybe doesn't feel, or as a woman writer who doesn't fit into sort of the comfortable stereotypes for women. And I think, you know, she might be perceived as being in trouble when actually she's okay, when actually she has a kind of internal stability, when actually this thread that she's kind of like attached her story to, even though it's an internal thread, even though it sort of like traverses a bunch of make-believe spaces and, you know, relationships to authors who don't live anymore or, you know, she's never met, that it's okay because it is very stable and very rich. And even if it's inside of her, it has a lot of the complexity of an external life that that most of us use to sort of measure whether someone's in a good space.
Yeah, I like that a lot, actually. That's a really good way to think of it. I mean, I think I agree with that, and also that stability is teetering at the same time. It seems hard won and fragile. And particularly, we haven't talked about the way that the beginning and the ending are in first person plural. The narrator describing herself as we.
Yes. I didn't think about it beyond you know, seeing it. So what do you see there?
Well, I don't know that I have anything beyond a very surface level interpretation of it, right? I mean, at a surface level, it does in fact suggest fracturing. It does in fact suggest that the text is coming from someone who at the time of creation is in fact mentally ill, right? I think there's probably more to it than that that I would be able to better parse on a second read. But I think it, if nothing else, I mean, I think that your point that like she's actually making all this work for herself as well as can be expected, I think that's a good one and I like it. And I also think that the use of that technique suggests that it's still, you know, the cracks are quite cracky, so to speak.
I think that, like you said, both can be true.
All right. Well, thank you much, everybody, for listening to the Book Spider podcast. That was our treatment of Checkout 19 by Claire Louise Bennett. A really excellent work that touches on some very interesting themes. If that's not an awfully generic description for a very creative and unusual book. Thank you much, everybody, and we'll see you in a couple weeks. And I remember what I was going to say before you get off the phone, Chris. I don't know. I don't think I have a good point about this. I think I just feel smart for drawing the connection, so I probably won't try to jam this into the podcast. But do you remember Living in the Maniototo by Janet Frame?
Yeah.
I was thinking about that a bit in relationship to this, actually, right? Because Living in the Maniototo, if I remember right, it's about an author, like it's written first person by an author who seems to be going at least somewhat insane, and her way of manifesting that insanity is to gradually interpolate her fictional creations into the work in a way where she loses track of which is which and has a moment of clarity that gives her panic, right? Yes. And this isn't exactly like that, but I think like the, you know, two texts that are both first person by a woman with an uncertain grasp on sanity interpolating her own creative work and kind of prodding the relationship between those things. They're not alike particularly, but they're probably more like each other than they are most other things, if nothing else. You know?
Yeah.
It kind of made me want to go back to Maniototo.
I love Living in the Maniototo. That's a really good connection. I think that, I think it's spot on, actually.
I love Maniototo. How did you, I can't remember, you were on the Carpathians podcast.
I chose Carpathians.
That was
y'all fucking hated it.
You chose Carpathians. I loved it. I thought Carpathians was great. Patrick hated Carpathians. I really enjoyed it, but I was baffled by it. But I remember it with great admiration, and I kind of want to read more Janet Frame.
Yeah, now. I kind of want to read more Janet Frame now too. This is making me want to read more Janet Frame. I wouldn't have made that connection.
Yeah, I might even look into that.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, I'll talk to you later.
All right. Talk
Hope
to you later.
Have a great afternoon.
Have a great afternoon or great evening, Hans, and have a great Easter.
I'll do my best.